This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2016, held at Faith Builders on August 1 through 5.
Saul has lost the Spirit of God, and he is reduced to ruling this nation as a natural man. Did you ever try to lead with your natural ability? That can be very frustrating. Now, it goes along smoothly as long as you have a little more natural ability than everybody else, but you're bound to meet somebody that one-ups you. And Saul was able to go on natural ability for a while because he was head and shoulders taller than everybody else. So he kind of could do it. But along came a man who had him beat by 2 feet. And all of a sudden, the one man, the strongest man in the nation, King Saul, is now cowering in his tent. And he's afraid because natural ability could only take him so far. And now he is stuck. And I have this feeling that he knew that the whole nation is looking at him. I mean, if there's anyone that's going to go out there and face that giant, it's going to be you. You're the big guy around here. And he is afraid because all he has is natural ability. And it only took him to 6 feet, 4 inches, however tall he was. Don't trust natural ability. If you go into the school and trusting your wit, God will send you a student who is wittier. How do I know? and you dig in your heels and you say, I'm going to somehow come up with another good one. But they just laugh at you, trying to outwit the tests that God has given you. No, don't try your wit. Don't trust in natural ability. Well, there's a war going on. And Jesse apparently is worried about this, because how long is it going to be before this king begins to start sending men out there to meet this Goliath? Now, you kings would have the authority to do that, right? You, go. And I guess maybe Jesse thought, you know, my sons, they've been clambering up the ladder trying to establish themselves. Maybe Saul will send them. So he sends David with carbohydrates and protein to get out there. And because Elihu may be the next, and he might need this. And so here goes David. I don't know. It doesn't appear that David knows anything, really, about Goliath. We don't know. But here he goes with bread and cheese to the battlefield. And he is unaware that by the end of the day, he will be a national sensation. This is not what he's looking for, but by default, that's what happens. Now, David walks into an entire army, trained army, and God looks down for a qualified man to fight Goliath. And he looks throughout the entire army, and he chooses the man with the bread and the cheese. Why? Why is David the qualified man to fight Goliath? Your verse from Psalm at the top of your handout is the verse I would like to look at, because it shows us David's perspective. See, the way David viewed this is what made all the difference. Psalm 9, verses 19 and 20. Arise, O Lord, let not man prevail. Let the heathen be judged in thy sight. Put them in fear, O Lord, that the nations may know themselves to be but men. David could fight Goliath because in that entire army, David was the spiritual man. He was not even trying to climb up and peg himself somewhere in the top of the natural man's list. He was fighting in an entire different paradigm. He was seeking God's glory and not his own. And going back to something we talked about yesterday, David saw what the natural men could not see. Goliath was small and insignificant. Goliath was a natural man, just a man. That's how God saw it. And since that's what David wanted to see, that's what David saw. And God looked down and said, here's the man that can slay this monster. Everyone else cowering in their tents. David comes up to Saul's tent and he volunteers for the job. Now, David did not come to that place overnight in an instant. God did prepare David for this moment. And you've made this observation before in studying this passage, I'm sure. I think it's encouraging for us as teachers to think about this. I've talked to numerous of you first-year teachers, and you're staring that huge mountain, and you wonder, how am I going to take this? I talked to one of you first-year teachers yesterday, and I asked you, what are you most concerned about when you think about teaching your first year? Everything. Well, thankfully, it doesn't all come at once. Just first, there's a lion, and then there's a bear. 1 Samuel 17, verse 37. David said, moreover, the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. God developed David's confidence one step at a time. And you be assured of that. He will do that for you too. First there will be a lion, and then there will be a bear. And finally God will say, you are ready now to face Goliath. And by the time that David is walking out with his sling and his stones, he is confident that God will not fail him. I remember how this... there's some things that have happened in my life that I simply cannot forget. Even telling it again brings back all the emotion. But we did not, in my community, our church did not make young men, they did not force them into teaching positions. We've changed that now in our community, but when I was young, it was not that way. And so I did not teach a Sunday school class until I was 23. Now, I just have a feeling that a whole lot of you here are not even 23 yet. And I was very afraid of anything, any speaking that was formal. I did not even speak and join discussion in Sunday school class. And somewhere around 22, 23, I had a youth teacher, Jessica's dad, if you know Jessica. And he decided that these boys are going to teach Sunday school. And I said no. And but the other boys did. They kind of got into this. They thought this was fun. Even the 17-year-old boys, they taught, and they got all pumped up about this. And I started feeling bad. Here are these 17-year-old boys that can teach Sunday school, and I'm too chicken. And this teacher didn't give up. He went home and bought a great big fat commentary book with all kinds of teacher helps. And he had his speech all ready, and he came to throw this book in my lap and say, Linford, I think you can do this. What he didn't know is that I was at home wrestling with God. I didn't want to do anything great. I didn't have any dreams of being a school teacher or anything, for sure. I just wanted to be able to be like the 17-year-olds. And so when he thrust that book at me and started his speech, I thought, if I can just have enough courage to put my hand up there and say yes, then maybe we'll get that far. We'll worry later how we're ever going to do it. And so I did. I said yes, and I took the book. I think he about fell over. And I went home I went home with this working theory that the way to settle these nerves is just to study and study and study and study until you are just have reams of notes, and then maybe the nerves will go away. And that's what I did all week long. And by Saturday night, I had a whole pile of notes and a whole pile of nerves. I had tonsillitis and laryngitis and appendicitis, and I don't know what all I had. And, you know, you probably remember that first time you did that, right? You go down there and your hands are shaking, your notes are quivering in your hands, and it's the closest thing to an out-of-body experience you can have. It doesn't sound like you. But our Sunday school classes last 45 minutes. I made it 25 minutes and I was to the end. And so I looked at him and I said, I've come to the end of the line. I don't have anything else to say. I don't even remember what we did for the rest of the class. But that day, I killed a lion. And it feels good to kill a lion. You know, we don't like fighting, but we enjoy having fought. And now I was a big 17-year-old. Eventually, they would ask me to get up in front of the church and have a topic. I had to do it all over again. But we killed a bear. And I would slay a number of lions and bears. And eventually, the same man, Jessica's dad again, came around and thought, you know what, I talked to the bishop, and we think you'd make a good school teacher. Now, I wasn't quite ready. I turned him down that time. Just wasn't quite time. But in a number of years, I would find the courage to slay Goliath. And that's how it will work for you. God will take you one little step at a time. And eventually, I walked into the classroom with a lot of nerves. There's no doubt about that on my first day of school. But I think there was a measure of confidence. God will not fail me. So David goes out to meet Goliath, and Goliath roars about his proclamation. What an idiot to come out here with a staff. Big people have always used intimidation. Right, Ryan? And David gives one of the most beautiful testimonies in the Bible about his God. Let's read it. 1 Samuel 17, 45 to 47. Then said David to the Philistine, "Thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. This day will the Lord deliver thee into mine hand. And I will smite thee and take thine head from thee, and I will give the carcasses of the host of the Philistine this day unto the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And all this assembly shall know that the Lord saveth not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." This is the climax of the story. And the giant isn't even dead yet. That's the amazing thing to me. Goliath is still roaring, and it's a done deal for David. Now let's make some observations about this testimony. I filled up the slide, so we'll have to get another one here. First observation I'd like to make out of those verses. David establishes his lifelong military strategy. The battle is the Lord's. That will always be number one. David will use method. David will use weapons. He will use ambush. But priority number one, this is not my thing, and this is not my campaign. The battle is the Lord's. Probably many a time he had to remind himself of that. Another observation I'd like to think about is that when David went out to fight Goliath, when David went out to stand there, he had a list of priorities. Do you think that his first priority was to see Goliath dead? I take you back to a phrase in those verses, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. I think that David's first priority while he walked out there with his five stones was to see Israel believe in God's power to fight their enemies. They were cowering in their tents. They were afraid. They could not do this thing. It was just one man out there and they were stuck. And David's like, let's rally this is my nation. These are my people. Let's fight for our God. And to somehow inspire them to do that, I think was at the very top of his list. Second, I think, was to see the Philistines run in fear from their God. And maybe thirdly, was to see Goliath dead and possibly gain Saul's reward. But I think that was somewhere distant down there. The next time you're fighting something big, stand back and think about that. We get our eyes on the monster and we forget about what's really behind it. What does God have in this? And how does God want to use me in this? There's another observation I would like to make here. We've already hinted at it. It has to do with how David viewed methods and weapons. David kept God first and conventional weapons second. Now, conventional weapons and methods are good in the right time and place. And interestingly, David would eventually be a user of conventional weapons. As a matter of fact, ironically, he would eventually use Goliath's sword, right? Now, both Goliath and David use the same sword. But when Goliath used the sword, it was priority number one. Nobody can wield this sword like me. When David used that sword, it was a secondary thing. He kept it in its right place. And I've wondered already, what kind of conventional methods are we tempted to trust in teaching? Sometimes teachers ask me, how do you do it at your school? Do you teach conventionally? Well, what does that mean? Yeah, I think we teach conventionally. But convention has changed, and we are in the middle of it changing yet again. It used to be that teaching conventionally was there was a warm-bodied person in the front of the classroom who presented the lessons, and he was an authority on those lessons, and the students knew he was the authority on those lessons. But convention is changing, and I wonder how much we will trust in it. I'll give you some examples. In 2010, I had a game-changing experience. In 2010, I went shopping and I bought me one of those little gadgets that allows you to hook up to the internet. What an experience. That was the same year that Nicholas Carr wrote his book, The Shallows. Did anyone here ever read that book? It's a book about how the internet is affecting our society. It'd be something good for you to consider reading if you like to have good discussions with people. For about 3 years, I was in my glory. I had the internet. The students didn't really know what to do with the internet yet. I had pictures. I had maps. I had illustrations. I could look for all kinds of interesting experiments and wow them every day. Recently, that's changed, and I am amazed at how fast it's changing. Today, it works something like this. I prepare for my history class, say the War of 1812, and I'm all ready for history. I'm all ready to talk about the War of 1812. I have my maps. I got my PowerPoint together. It's going to work. And I'm ready to teach class, and a boy shoots up his hand. because he had been reading the assignment on the War of 1812, right? He shoots up his hand right before class starts and says, "Brother Linford, I watched this amazing documentary last night on the War of 1812. You should have saw it. It was incredible." And he wants me to give him 5 minutes to talk about this documentary. I mean, since when did I start competing with YouTube? And then I shush him. And one of the students says, "Hey, you can download things off of YouTube. Why don't you bring it in and show us? We want to see it." Well, I had something ready here to share. Don't you want to hear that? I have my science experiment all ready. I got it set up. We're going to illustrate some physics concepts here. And I've even got a discrepant event, you know, a surprise factor that's going to make them ask all kinds of questions, want to know what happened. And I'm ready to go, and all of a sudden the boy says, "Oh yeah, Mythbusters does an episode on that. Yeah, we know it. We know. Yeah, you should watch that. The way they do that is amazing." And so I do my little discrepant event, and then they want to tell me how Mythbusters does it, and I'm supposed to compete with Mythbusters. I went home and I pulled up a Mythbusters episode to see what I was competing against. I don't know. I didn't see the image of the invisible God. Entertaining, I guess, but it used to be that the school was the center of. That's where you came to do research. You would give a research assignment. The students would go to the library. They would get their things and start doing research. Now, when you give an assignment, and you tell them, "Okay, go ahead and get started. You can get these books and that," and they just kind of look at you. Can we do our research at home? Because you see, our school has decided that we are not going to let the internet come in our school. So they got to go home to do their research now. So there we are. We're just kind of, you know, I thought they were going to do their research, but they want to do it at home. And then they go home and bring the strangest stuff back. Where do they find this stuff? Well, they Googled it, and that's what came up top. And so then I have to help them wade through this. Now, what for blogs do they read? Now, convention is changing. What are we going to do with all that? I hope you're thinking about that. And there's a lot of discussions these days about that. I tell you what, I'll give you an assignment. I saw a lot of literature out here in this hall, some articles from Faith Builders News Lines. John Mark Koontz wrote an article. Maybe some of you read it. Why Teach in the Age of Google? If you haven't read that article yet, you go out here and get it. It's laying out here. He did some good thinking about that. Why teach in the age of Google when students can just... Convention is changing, but there are reasons why we still need Christ, the hope of glory, in the front of the classroom. I hope you're convinced of that. I hope conventional methods are always secondary. Well, whenever convention starts letting us down, we have a temptation, and that is to all of a sudden react. Big time reaction. We'll fly over here and try something really unconventional. Have you ever been tempted to do that? Well, let's look at David here again. David kept God first, and unconventional methods, weapons, second. Now, it is true that David did use an unconventional method. The unconventional method had its time, and it had its place. But he didn't do it because he was reacting, necessarily, to something that was conventional. This is what he was, his priority number one was his God and the glory of God. And well, okay, I have this slingshot. I know how to use it. And so that's what we're going to do. But David did not trust in his slingshot. David trusted in his God. When he killed the lion and when he killed the bear, he didn't kill them with a slingshot. The Bible says that he grabbed the lion by its beard and slew him. Yeah, it wasn't that. I suppose he practiced with his slingshot, but it wasn't that he was going around doing everything with a slingshot. First of all, there was a list of priorities. The method was somewhere firmly in the secondary role. Now, Malcolm Gladwell, I don't know how many of you enjoy him as an author. He's a humanistic sociologist that writes books like Tipping Point and Outliers. He wrote a book called David and Goliath. And since, you know, I'm going to talk about David and Goliath at Faith Builders, I should read that and see if there's anything good in there. Well, I was sort of disappointed with Malcolm Gladwell because he likes to study, you know, different ways people relate to their environment. And so the David and Goliath, the book he wrote on David and Goliath, is about the underdog, how they sometimes rise to the top. And in his first chapter, he tells the story of David and Goliath. And this is his interpretation. David won out over Goliath because he used an unconventional surprise method that Goliath was not counting on. That's the way the humanists like to study things. Look how David did that. Goliath thought he was going to come with a sword and fight conventionally, and David surprised him and fought unconventionally and got him. And don't let the humanists deceive you there. David did not trust in his sling. The sling worked because God was behind it. How silly of David to have gathered the soldiers all around and said, "Fellas, there's advantages to disadvantages, and there's disadvantages to advantages. Let's think unconventionally." And out he goes, looking for some kind of hidden advantage that no one else thought of. What do you think would have happened? I trusted in an unconventional weapon once. It's kind of an embarrassing story. It actually doesn't have anything to do with teaching. I told you I drove a truck. Maybe I didn't tell you what I hauled, but we hauled livestock. We were livestock haulers. Worked with animals a lot. I worked with hogs. That was my preparation for working with children. No similarities whatsoever. We used to have this discussion in the livestock industry. Which is more dangerous, a 2,000-pound bull or a 600-pound boar hog? Always made interesting discussion. We never really came to any good conclusions, depending on whether you wanted broken bones or a lot of blood. I went to a sale barn one day after a sale and had to load a bunch of 600-pound, 700, 800-pound boar hogs. They have big tusks sticking out of their mouth, about 3 inches. Very dull. They're as dull as your thumb. It looked about like your thumb. And I had to keep them all in separate components of the truck, in decks. The decks are about 4.5, 5 feet high. And put one in a compartment, close it, so they don't fight. I ended up at the end. I had one compartment left down under there. And I had two boar hogs left. So I put them in together because I was only going 20 minutes down the road. I thought maybe they'll make it. As soon as I put them together in there, they begin to fight. But I had an electric stock prod. They are very useful tools, even in the classroom. Only for object lessons in chapel. And that thing, I was convinced that tool could do anything. And the boys at the stockyard, they were scared. They were afraid of those things. They'd hide behind the fence. And I was going to show them, you know, how to do this. You just walk behind them and you tap them and you shock them with a little electricity and they go right along. And those two big boar hogs begin to fight under there. And I still cannot believe I did such a stupid thing. But I had pride in my heart and I was going to convince those scaredy cats in there that I wasn't afraid to go in under there and separate it. They had to be separated. We had to do it. And so there was only one way to do it. I crawled down there with him and shocked the one out. And they stopped fighting like good little boys. And the one walked out. And I walked out behind him. The boar hog behind me followed me out. And God said to the boar hog, "Would you teach that arrogant fool a lesson?" And the boar said, "I'd be much obliged." And he put his head down and he brought his head up. He hit me one time. I do not know what would have happened if he'd hit me the second time. I have to end my story there. The rest is too bloody. You can ask me details later if you want. But I spent weeks lying there not able to walk, thinking about how stupid to trust in a weapon, in my little shocker. And David, if he would have went out there trusting in unconventionality in his slingshot, his dying words could just as well have been, "How stupid of me to think that I could have taken down this giant with a slingshot." No. The battle was the Lord's. So we need to watch these things. Conventionality is changing. And how are we going to approach that? How much do we trust in it? Especially think about that if you teach students from 7th grade up. They are very tuned in to the internet and technology, and somehow the Mennonites used to be readers, but we've become watchers. How do we as teachers relate to all that? And I don't think that the answer is some foolish, unconventional reaction. Although, possibly, God will have us do some unconventional things, but only in a secondary role. Now, I would like to look at another giant that David faced. Goliath was not the only giant that David faced. He faced another giant. He had a strange name. Anybody know his name? Well, you got to be a real Bible scholar to pull this one off. Anyone ever do those Bible quizzing clubs on 1 Samuel? Maybe you would know. Here's the verse. His name, how do you say it? Ishbi-benob. All tough guys have always needed tough-sounding names, right? Well, there's one for you. You want to be the next big pro wrestler? I got a name for you. Ishbi-benob. There he is. And David is facing him. Which was the sons of the giant, the weight of whose spear weighed 300 shekels of brass. Now, he's not as big as Goliath. Goliath's spear was 600 shekels of iron. I suppose iron would weigh more than brass. He, being girded with a new sword, thought to have slain David, but Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, succored him, which is an old word we don't use anymore, which means relieved David, and smote the Philistines and killed him. Now, here is David. After all these years, the battle has always been the Lord's, and he's facing a giant. Something doesn't work out quite right here. All of a sudden, David is not able to do what he once did. I guess he got tired. He was old. His strength just wasn't what it used to be. Maybe something even happened to his faith. Somewhere along the lines, some weaknesses came into his life, and it just wasn't what he was at one time. But the observation I want you to make here is that David had done his homework. David had actually slain Ishbi-benob many years ago because of his list of priorities. David is faint and not able to stand before the giant. But years ago, David had a vision, and that was to convince his nation to trust in the God of Israel to bring down the enemies of the Lord. And Abishai was one of those men who caught the vision. Abishai didn't always have the right heart, but he followed David loyally to his dying day. Abishai is always beside David. Let's do this. I'm with you. And in the day when David failed, his homework had paid off. And the men that he had inspired to follow him stood beside him. Okay, David's going down, but I'm here. And the sons of the giant began to fall. See, Goliath was not the end of the giant fighting. There was a lion, and then there was a bear, and then there was Goliath, and then there were the sons of the giant. And then there was the entire nation of the Philistines that were constantly coming. And the battle was always the Lord's. And by the time that Solomon is sitting on the throne, you will never again read in the Bible about the threat of the Philistines. It is over. They're still neighbors. They still live there, over there by the Mediterranean Sea, but they are subdued. One man started that process. His name was David. One man who believed that God saw Goliath as just a man. And God can help me take him down. David knew how to keep both conventional and unconventional methods in their proper secondary place. He inspired a nation to fight the Lord's battles. And so a lion went down, and a bear went down, and Goliath went down, and so on and so on. And I hope you're encouraged. When you face something big, stand back and seek the Lord's will on those things. He will not let you down. The giants won't all fall at once. They come, and by God's grace, they go. And we use conventional methods, and we use unconventional methods, and we'll talk a lot about those things this week. But we keep them in their place, somewhere subservient to the power of God. Enjoy your day.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.